now we'll open for the next 15 minutes or so for a discussion. If you're a brother in the church and you have a question, raise your hand. We'll get the microphone to you. Stand up and talk into the microphone. No noise will come through the speakers, but it will be recorded. So please talk into the microphone for the benefit of the recording. We'll begin with Brother Alan Bonifay.
I thought that was very interesting, David, and I think you're probably right on all of these. I'm not sure about the Acts 28:22 any more than you are, but what you said was reasonable. So I want to ask you, if I can, about a cognate. So a heretic after the first and second admonition reject. So a heretic, according to what you've said, you tell me if this is what you said, is a factious or divisive person, and the faction he builds may be around a false doctrine or more than one, or it may be around a personality issue. But the point is, he is a divisive person in the congregation.
That's the way I understand it, yes.
Okay. Can I ask one more question? In 1 Corinthians 11:19, what does the passage mean? I think you're right on how the word is used there in 1 Corinthians 11:19 of factions. But what does he actually mean when he said there must be factions among you that those who are approved may be recognized?
Well, that's a good choice or a good question because I think your question may be about, it almost sounds like he's saying that it's a good thing that you've got heresies among your factions. Is that may
it sounds good? Like that. I it don't think that's what that. He's saying. But
I don't think that's what Paul means. Let me get to the verse here so I can read it to people. I mean, most of us probably can quote it, but, well, I take Paul to mean here not that he's saying that factions are a good thing, but that when factions occur, it shows shows the true stripes of everybody, including the factious people and the faithful people.
Yeah,
I don't know if that explains your question or answers your question or not.
Well, I thought I had it up here on my phone. I could look at it. Ellicott says that this is probably a reference to what Jesus said when he said there must be. What did Jesus say? There must be. What? Yeah, in that passage. And that what he's saying here is there are obviously divisions at Corinth, and so some of these must be offenses so that the one who's right can be approved or can be recognized.
Yeah.
Something like that.
That's the way I take the passage. Well, I think everybody wants to believe.
We've got 10 minutes they can sit there while we keep on working according to decorum.
Okay.
So I've got, I'll ask two quickly. One, since you can have a heresy or a sect or faction form without false doctrine, so it can form around a cult of personality or something like that, can people form a sect around a true doctrine? In other words, can we take a something that is true, but elevate it perhaps in a way that it was not intended to be elevated, so as to form an identity that excludes others based on that truth, but in a destructive way?
Well, the way you framed the question, it seems to me that the answer is obviously yes. I mean, it would be possible. I can't think of a good example off the top of my head, but...
So we can think about this. Would it be possible for us to do something like that
with what we believe about how to observe the Lord's Supper, or what we believe about not using Bible classes or instrumental music. And I think about, I have never been one, I've never liked to identify myself as a one-cupper. I believe in one cup with all my heart. I'll never do it another way, as long as I have a say in it. I would never do it another way because I believe it's what the Bible teaches. But I don't like calling myself that because I think that's a sectarian term. There's a lot more to my faith than just my belief about the Lord's Supper.
Right.
But I think if we use that term, sometimes we develop the mindset that that is the most important thing about being a Christian. And as long as you have one cup on the table, then you've got it all settled as far as faithfulness to God. Would that be, whenever I read Campbell, that's what just sort of jumped off the page and hit me in the face. And I wondered, well, is that true? Is it possible to form a sect or a faction around something that's true? Because we treat it in a way that it was not intended to be treated. And that's probably not the best way of expressing it, but maybe you understand what I'm saying and asking.
Yes, I do. In fact, when you put it that way, I think you're right. I, you know, we jokingly throw around the label one cupper just in jest a lot, but I never introduce myself to anyone under that label like that, because just like you say, it makes it sound like that that's the beginning and ending, the tell-all of everything that I'm about, and it's not. And I feel like maybe there are brethren sometimes who feel that way just based on things they say, but a lot of times when they get up and wait on the table, I just wonder sometimes, is that what we have to get up and say to the church about the cup and what have you? There's more to the Lord's Supper than the cup. Although I'm never going to use anything else but a single cup. I don't mean that it's not important, but no, I understand what you mean. I would, unless someone can point out where I or you are wrong, I would answer that yes.
I have the same concern about using the term Church of Christ in that kind of a way. And people saying, I'm a Church of Christ preacher, and this is a Church of Christ book, and these are Church of Christ songs, and so on. That seems to me like a sectarian usage of the term to identify our people, what we do and what we believe. And I mean, I've seen people use it even to the point of how many songs should you have before the main prayer, and whether or not you should open or close with a dismissal prayer and so on. And they use that term Church of Christ in a sectarian way to describe some traditional practices that aren't inherently wrong, but they aren't inherently essential either. But they develop an air of essentiality when we gather them under a sectarian term, even if it's a good term. I believe in the term Church of Christ. It's a Bible term, and I use it. But I think it's wrong to use it that way, or I would think so. I wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, yeah. In a way, given our climate, given our surroundings, the world we live in, we are sometimes forced into that, or we feel forced into it, you know, because you talk with people on the outside, and they want to know who you are and what you are, and while you say Church of Christ, they are thinking, and it's very difficult to carry on a conversation up to a point where you just kind of have to explain to someone that that's not really, I don't mean it like you're thinking it. And sometimes conversations don't lend themselves to going into great detail about that. But I think sometimes I hear some brethren talk, and I wonder sometimes if they really do understand that. And I think that may be what you're speaking to, maybe. But I'm just rambling now, so.
Let's go to Matt Cooter now.
I want to build a little bit off of what Clint asked, but this would be in a more practical direction. To what extent should we seek to repair a faction or a sect? If we want to look at something like cups and classes, that's a pretty big extent that we have to reach out to try to repair that. There are many congregations that worship in such a way. But we have other areas that are much easier or much closer to home, like the issue of divorce and remarriage. To what extent should we try to repair the rift that has been made from this, and then beyond that, like cups, classes, and even beyond that?
Well, as much as we can. I mean, that's what, a lot of what we've tried to do for years is when we visit with our friends or neighbors or make contacts with people in any of those groups, we're essentially trying to, I mean, usually what we're trying to do is not so much heal the whole breach as we are just to win some people over to the truth. And if we can win enough people over, then maybe we could end the division. But that's a big job, of course, given the fact that, you know, at this point, let's just use the cups and classes. We've got a century now of division where there is a hard, there's a hard division here where ultimately there's a sect involved somehow. When people are going off with a practice that they can't read about in the scriptures, they would call us a sect. But they would do it in the sense that people think of a sect as kind of a negative, small group that is out of the mainstream. But the reality is when people go off with a false doctrine, they've formed a sect, even if it's three times bigger than the truth, or the people who follow the truth. When it gets that big of a distinction, of course, I don't know if we'll ever completely solve it or dissolve it, but our effort is to try to do what we can. I don't know if I've answered your question, but
that brings us right about to the end, but we have just about 2 minutes left. I wondered if you could make a comment on what you told me just a few days ago about linguistics, and particularly when we are confronted with the argument that a word, if it's translated this way one time, it has to have the same meaning every time. You've talked about that, but you mentioned to me that what we know as linguistics didn't really exist in Campbell's day.
Yeah.
What does that mean, and how does that impact our Bible study today, and how we should use older resources when we read them?
Well, back when Campbell lived, the field of the study of the language of the New Testament was called philology. And it was strictly focused on the language of the New Testament. In fact, they thought the Greek of the New Testament was a Holy Ghost language, that it was never used by anyone except the apostle. Then in the early 1900s, they discovered a bunch of documents that demonstrated otherwise, that actually the language of the New Testament is the common language of the everyday people. Then early in the 20th century, I'm not trying to make this a long answer, but linguistics as a separate field broke off from philology, and linguistics began to investigate the study of language as language and not just study this language versus that language. And the insights of linguistics, especially in the last 50 years, on the study of New Testament Greek is just amazing. In fact, that's how we've got today with the DBAG 2000 and the Low and NIDA lexicons. These dictionaries have come out of the efforts to incorporate some of the things learned by linguistics. And these lexicons are a stride ahead of anything that has ever been in the past, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of other people for that matter. But as far as translating different words in different ways, you know, a lot of people would look at this as Campbell did. This was kind of a philosophy back then, was that you translate the word the same way throughout the scripture. But what you end up with is something that is very stilted and oftentimes not very clear when you do that. And that's why I said that we should go with more nuance and break it out in the way that I broke it out. Here's just an illustration. Just because a word translates one way in one passage doesn't mean that it must translate the same way in every passage. Let's put it in modern terms. In English, we have a little idiom that we use. We use the word get, G-E-T, in so many different ways. We say, I need to go get some bread. Or, I need to get some bread, or I need to get ready to go, or, I can't think of 100 different examples that we commonly use. But I heard this somewhere, or read it somewhere, that if you took all the different ways that we use the word get in English and tried to translate those statements into German, you would have to have 18 different German words to represent the meaning of get in English. So just because a word means one thing in one place in our language, and therefore we can use it somewhere else in another place, doesn't mean that another language is necessarily going to uniformly translate it that way. Is this answering the question? And so the same is with heresies. So.
Thank you very much, brother. We really appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Thank you.